Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. The Seahawks are Super Bowl 60 champions. Coming up on Inside Coverage, former Seahawks Super Bowl champion Robert Turbin joins us. How it was different this time from when they won Super Bowl 53. Plus, Ben Fox joins me as well. Inside Coverage is next. It is another edition. It is your post-Super Bowl edition. It is the day after the season ends, 285 games edition of Inside Coverage on Yahoo. Thank you for being here today, friends. Hope you're doing well. I am on the road. I am no longer in the Bay Area. You are looking live at a hotel room in Connecticut, NBC headquarters. Connecticut is the Italy of the United States. Does that make sense? Connecticut is the Milan of the United States. Trying to figure this out. We'll workshop it later. Either way, I'm hosting Gold Zone with my dear friend Scott Hansen, who was on the show back when we had Inside Coverage on the road in San Francisco. Scott and I are doing Gold Zone. Matt Eisman, Jack Collinsworth as well. Although Jack was on Alcatraz on Super Bowl Sunday. He is getting here, and then we are, along with Ashley Wagner, bringing you any and everything you need to see every single day of the Olympics. And this podcast, any and everything you need to know about the National Football League. A season that ended game 285 with, in Super Bowl 60, the Seahawks winning their second Lombardi Trophy. They beat the Patriots 29-13. Frank is traveling, Jory is traveling, Charles is traveling. They were all at the game. So in their place today, a dear friend, a guy who has a ring with the Seahawks, the last time they won a Super Bowl. You can now hear him on Sirius XM NFL radio. You can hear him on Saturdays calling college football games, and you can see him on your screen right here. Seahawks Super Bowl champion, Robert Turbin. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. You know I'm feeling good. You know I'm feeling good.
Of course you're feeling good. And all the Seahawks family, all the 12s obviously feeling good. Man, I wanted a game last night. That's all I wanted. Like when I was up in Seattle for the NFC Championship game, Rams gave him a game. Rams scored 85 points on him in three games. Number of defense. Mm-hmm. I so badly wanted a game, Turbo. I so badly, you know, just wanted at one point this to actually feel like it was a fair fight. I mm-hmm. didn't feel it. Both can be true. At the same time, I'm happy for you. I'm happy for the Seahawks fans, and I'm happy for the 12s, but I just wanted more.
Yeah. Well, you weren't going to get it, you know. You weren't going to get it because the reality is going into the game, evaluating the game, right? Evaluating both teams, giving your predictions and who's got the edge and why. It's like, Seattle had everything. Much more horsepower, much more speed, much more power, much more physicality. And, you know, the Patriots, you know, kind of snuck their way in through the back door. And everybody wants to say,
is that really how you look at it?
Well, not necessarily, because I think it's unfair to the guys. It's hard work now. Every day, showing up on time, right? Bringing your best through soreness, through injury, right, through personal issues that you might have when you come to the facility day in and day out, the hours that the coaches are putting in. I think it'd be unfair to really phrase it that way, but they did have some things bounce their way this year in terms of the ball bouncing in their direction. No Bo Nix, right? No Nico Collins against the Texans, etc. Okay. At the end of the day, though, it's clear the Seahawks are the better team. My prediction was 31-14. And I got pretty close. If I were a betting man, I might be rich.
We're going to talk about this later with Ben Fox, but do you think less of the Patriots? Like I keep saying, I said it all year, like both can be true. They had an easy schedule and they're a good team. Like they're not a bad team. You don't make it this far. I don't care what your schedule is unless you're a good football team. But there are a lot of people taking shots at Drake May during the game on social media, which is not like a real barometer of how the rest of the football world feels. But you saw that, you felt that, people taking shots at their schedule, people taking shots to the AFC. I thought that was unfair, Turbo.
You know, it was unfair, all right? Because Drake May, I think, did everything that he could in this game. I think you got to look at the totality of what was going on. You got Kayshon Booty, You got Stephon Diggs. You got Hunter Henry locked up. At some point, your guys got to win one-on-one on the outside.
Yeah.
Now, did Drake May miss some throws? Sure. Also, you got to kind of look at McDaniels a little bit. Josh. Because what was Seattle doing defensively? They kept bringing that weak side linebacker and Witherspoon off the nickel. Where's the high route? Where's the quick swing play to Stephon Diggs right there who's lined up in the slot? You got to have an answer for that kind of stuff. That play right there. All Stephon Diggs has to do is just turn around and catch the ball. He's going to get 6 yards. Why is he still running a 10 to 12 yard route when his defender is blitzing off the edge consistently throughout the game?
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because the opening possession of the game, right, where they brought Witherspoon off the defense's right side the very first time, and they don't blitz a lot. They play pressure, they play zone, they win one-on-ones, and that's how they get you. It's where the pressure is coming from. That's the genius of Mike McDonald, for those who don't fully grasp what the Seahawks do. It's not that I'm going to blitz you to death. It's where is the pressure coming from? And they don't blitz that often. When they brought Witherspoon to that first one, and that was my first, like, where's the hot? Like, you throw into the blitz. They never knew where the blitz was coming from.
No, they didn't. They couldn't recognize it. And that's where then, if you want to criticize Drake May for that, sure. You know, you can. But also, you got to look at Josh McDaniel, because even when you look at the route concept, it really didn't set Drake May up to be successful against those blitz concepts. And so, look, credit the mastermind of Mac McDonald, because you said it, Andrew. They're not a blitzing team. But they schemed this offense up for this game, and they brought timely pressures, and they worked.
Did you think when they got Sam Darnold last March that you would get this Sam Darnold?
I'll be honest. When they acquired Sam Darnold, my first thought was that they're upgrading at quarterback, okay? Now, I didn't say that in the beginning, Andrew, because the truth is, when you're a former player, you got homeboys, okay?
And I
so
get it.
You want to be careful.
So full
about
disclosure, you and I last year did a training camp show, and we're sitting there interviewing Gino, who I love. Like, I love Gino, want nothing but the best, but just for the background there.
Yeah, exactly. And so to say that early, I wasn't ready yet. That's the reality of it. But also the truth is that there was some leadership being lost at that position, okay, with Geno Smith being there. There was a separation happening between Geno and some of the other players, DK, right? And that leadership and that message was falling on deaf ears. So you had to go in another direction at quarterback. And so Sam Darnold comes in, different perspective, different voice, different leadership style, and it's worked out perfectly for Seattle. And so did I expect him to win the Super Bowl? Probably not. I had the Seattle Seahawks winning 10 games this season, okay? But he proved everybody wrong, and that's what sports is all about.
Your guy Kenneth Walker got 27 carries, and we have a running back winning the MVP for the first time since Terrell Davis. The running back in your heart had to feel good, man.
No doubt about it. I got asked about Kenneth Walker III before the game. Is he ready for this? Well, you guys, Kenneth Walker was carrying a ball 20-plus times before Zach Charbonnet got there. This is not something he isn't used to, being the bell cow guy. Okay? Zach Charbonnet was just a compliment to the backfield. They supported each other. That 1-2 punch was great. But just because he goes down, doesn't mean he can't carry the load. If Kenneth Walker would have gone down, I believe Zach Charbonnet would have been able to carry the load. Here's a special thing about Kenneth Walker III. My running backs coach played 9 seasons as a running back. Sherman Smith was his name, okay? Mm-hmm. And he's talking about Marshawn a lot because he coached Eddie George as well. Remember Eddie George? Hall of Famer. He said, man, he told me one day, he said, man, the one special thing about Marshawn is that any given play you give him the ball, you feel like he's going to take it to the house. And when you watch Kenneth Walker, I feel like in his own way, he's got that same ability because his run style is so unpredictable. You don't know when he's cutting back. You don't know when he's going to bounce it to the outside. You don't know when he's going to be patient at the line of scrimmage, hit you with a spin move. But he's got that speed and acceleration, special speed, I should say, to be able to take it to the house from anywhere. And I think it showed. I think his greatness really showed on the biggest stage last night.
Yeah, and for those who only remember Kenneth Walker from his big year, his final year when he got to the Big Ten, when he got to Michigan State, the patient style that we saw last night that we've seen really all season with him, and he's going to get paid because he's hitting free agency, good for him, was what we saw with that offense they ran at Wake Forest before he got to Michigan State, where he's really patient. They're running out of the pistol, and he's slow played everything. That is his style. And Chris Collinsworth said last night, well, this is the most patient run I think I've ever seen, where he busted a long one late. I'm happy for him, and he's going to get paid. I know running backs don't get paid. I know he's not Saquon, but I hope Kenneth Walker gets paid. I want to talk about John Schneider, because when you guys won, you had Pete Carroll. John Schneider was there. You hit reset on the entire thing, not just the quarterback, but obviously trading Russell. You have a brand new head coach, Mike McDonald, in his second season. When they traded Russell, among the stuff they got back, you get the 9th overall pick, you take Charles Cross, you get the 5th overall pick, you take Devin Weatherspoon, who was a terror last night, the corner out of Illinois, you take Boye Mafe, who played last night as well and contributed as they come at you in waves on that front seven. Drew Locke obviously was the backup quarterback. He didn't need him, but John Schneider was able to rebuild all because of a trade. I mean, it is hard to do that, to take the quarterback with which you won a Super Bowl and know when the time is right to say we're going to move him, and from that trade, build another Super Bowl team.
What John Schneider has taught us and other front office executives is that you can't be afraid to make the tough decision. You have to be willing to make the hard choice. Think about if the Steelers would have gotten rid of Ben Roethlisberger maybe about 4 or 5 years earlier, how that would have impacted their team in a positive way. Just one example of probably many that we could use in terms of teams potentially holding on to a quarterback or anybody at a big time position for too long. John Schneider is one of the most honest people I've ever worked with. And I think that is why he's had so much success in the executive position. He doesn't treat players like product. He treats players like people. And I think that's why he's had a lot of success.
I love the guy. I told the Mike McDonald story, Turbo. I told it last week how right after 2 years ago when McDonald got hired, we go to the annual meeting, all of us in the little NFL world, we go to the annual meeting, the league meeting, the owners meeting, whatever you want to call it down in Florida. John introduced me to Mike, and we talked a lot during those couple of days, and I just watched Mike observe the room. He didn't have to be like, you know, class president meeting everybody as a new guy. He just observed, all right? And John Schneider was kind of his guy, and as you know, he could be the life of the party as well. And they were just so different. They were so opposite. And I'm like, This is a different pairing, because now maybe Mike, I don't know, have you ever seen Mike McDonald open up? I have not.
I mean, last night was the first time I've ever seen him even get fired up the way that he was on the sideline.
But it was like this. It was barely.
Exactly. Hey, you know, I say opposites attract, man. I think as long as you have the similar vision in terms of how to win and, you know, how to get it done, the same values. I think John and Mike, they share the same values in terms of running a team and how to win, you know, in this league. And even though their personalities are, I bet John Schneider was somewhere in San Francisco last night with his shirt off and just, you know, having a blast. And Mike McDonald's probably sitting at the dinner table somewhere like this, you know, chilling. You know what I'm saying? But they know how to win, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, they do, and they won, and they're already the co-favorites, as often the team is that wins, along with the Rams, to come out of the NFC. The defense that Mike McDonald has employed, it is a copycat league. Jesse Minday is a very similar system as well. Do you think, because when the Seahawks won last time, obviously you were there. I mean, cover three kind of became the thing. Do you think this is now the defense that everybody copies? Is it easier said than done?
Yeah, way easier said than done. Because you got to look at the players Seattle has. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to look at the acquisitions John made to the defense. Ernest Jones. I mean, I've never seen a linebacker. I've never seen, you know, someone trade for a linebacker, a starting linebacker, twice in one season. You go get Ernest Jones, DeMarcus Lawrence, you know, free agency, who I think was the X factor really in this defense. Julian Love was a key piece that they went and acquired. Obviously, Leonard Williams. So you go and get. I mean, these are good players. They before they came to Seattle, they were the best players on their team, on their unit. Okay, outside of maybe DeMarcus Lawrence because Michael Parsons was over there. All right, but Julian Love, well-known safety in New York, etc. So you got to look at the personnel. It's going to be hard to match that. But obviously what Mike McDonald has done is, you know, he's done such a good job. Okay, what are the skill sets? How can I position these guys to be successful? We talk about that often. But look at a guy like Kobe Bryant, you know, who came into the league as an outside corner. He went inside to nickel. And Mike McDonald, you know, he said actually during this week before the game, in San Francisco, how he moved him to safety. Kobe didn't really like it. He wasn't really comfortable with it. But he told him, he says, man, I think you'd be a really talented safety. And he's starting. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hard to replicate something like that.
And look, Kobe Bryant's a guy that came in with a pedigree. I mean, Jim Thorpe Award winner, if I recall correctly, coming out of Louisville. So it's not as if he couldn't play. It's not as if he was getting by on you know, his name, spelled differently, obviously, than late, great Kobe Bryant, the guy that played basketball. But the Seahawks found ways to make these pieces work. And they're also holdovers from Pete Carroll's administration. Obviously, Julian Love was a guy that Pete Carroll convinced to take the free agent money when he became a free agent to come to Seattle, because that system at the time, Pete's system, you know, they convinced him, you can work here. And it did. And now he's a holdover. And now he is a Super Bowl champion as well. We only have so much time here, so there's a lot of stuff I want to get to. But just one more thing. You're a Bay Area guy. You weren't at the game, for those who don't know, but you spent a lot of time in San Francisco this past week. How cool was it to have, for the first time in 10 years, the Bay Area get a Super Bowl? I thought they did a good job from the time that I was there.
Yeah, you know, the Super Bowl is one thing, but I'm almost getting emotional talking about it, man. I grew up in the Bay Area. Really? San Francisco used to be, yeah, you know. And Frisco, man, you see, the out of town is called San Fran. See, we call it Frisco, you know. Mm-hmm. But, man.
And you hate when we call it San Fran.
We've accepted it now. We've accepted it. Oh, man. It used to be the spot, man. You know, you would go to San Francisco, you go to a Giants game, go to the pier, you just do all kinds of stuff. And the weekends, it was like, you know, it was crowded. It was, you know, it was the place to be. And then, you know, like a lot of other places after the pandemic, right, that kind of, you know, fell off a little bit. And so to see it like it was this week, I mean, just packed. You know, just packed in a good way. Unless you were driving, then you're probably frustrated somewhere. Okay. That's why I got to get somewhere and walk. It was awesome, bro. It was really awesome to see San Francisco really lit up the way it was this week.
Yeah. And look, the traffic and the walking and taking forever to get from point A to point B, I mean, that's every Super Bowl. That is Vegas. That is New Orleans. But New Orleans, like, I enjoy, even though not all that, it's walkable, at least. Indianapolis is walkable. I'm all for a walkable Super Bowl. A lot of the events late in the week in San Francisco were walkable. Many were not, obviously. Mm-hmm. But San Francisco is a great town. It's a great restaurant town. It's a great cultural town. It's a great people town. We had a very cool setup in the Yahoo offices near the Moscone Center, where from our windows you can look out and you can see the ballpark and you can see the water. It's a beautiful town. It's so much more than downtown. Obviously, the game was in Silicon Valley. There's Napa. There's the East Bay. There's it's a massive, massive, massive region, as you well know, growing up there. I think it's always great when Northern California can be in the spotlight. And next year, Southern California, where I call home, will be in the spotlight, as well as the torch was officially passed as it is at the end of every Super Bowl, the next day on Monday, to the next host city, which is L.A., back at SoFi again, as it was in 2021 when the Rams won. So Inglewood for Super Bowl 61. Robert Turbin,
sounds like
congratulations again, man.
Right there.
I mean, sounds like a party at my house. How about that?
Okay.
God
well, let
willing,
me get the invite
party at my
time.
House. Or
also to the Yahoo office will, the next time you guys are set up in at the Super Bowl.
Okay. Whether it's the Yahoo office or you and I can have a cocktail somewhere or a cup of coffee, whatever makes you happy, in Southern California. Hopefully, though, we talk between now and then, and that it's not 51 weeks until we do this again. Congratulations, Turbo, to you, to the Seahawks family. Man, thanks for coming on, especially on short notice. I appreciate you.
Anytime, man. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
The great Robert Turbin, everybody. Seahawks Super Bowl champion. The last time they won. Coming up next, Inside Coverage continues. Ben Fox is here. His view on Super Bowl Sunday from where he sits in his betting world. That's coming up. Our roadshow continues here on Inside Coverage. And I want to say how great it was. I know we talked about this last week, but Ben Fox and I had never met. You know, our gambling expert is here every Thursday, like we did our preview shows, our pick shows every Thursday. Ben and I finally got to meet in San Francisco. Ben's on the show now. But Ben, like, I was sitting out of San Francisco so fast. It was like, hey, Ben, Andrew, Ben. And then it was like, Ben, we didn't like get a chance to raise a glass or actually talk.
Yeah, it was a solid, you know, 45 to 60 seconds. I think I pretty much got your life story. We're well acquainted. Like, what else is there? No, it was great to meet you and so many people in person, and certainly doing like the shows live is great. There's definitely something for being in the same place. And that studio and set also were fantastic. It just looked awesome too. It was a great week.
Can I just say this, and I know I hit it with Turbo a little bit. Thanks for Robert Turbin coming on, by the way. But, dude, I had so much FOMO. I love the Olympics. Like, this is not a secret. Like, both can be true. I love my Olympics assignment. I absolutely, unequivocally wrap my arms around it and want to be here. It's also the Super Bowl. Like, I had FOMO. But the FOMO wasn't the game, and I really do mean this. I'm just not saying this. The FOMO was, like, hanging out with and working with all you guys, because we work remotely with Charles and Jory and Frank and you, and great to see Fitz and Caroline as well, Yahoo Sports Daily. Like, we all work remotely, and I so badly wanted to like spend that time together. Madison, Brett, everybody, Matt, like let's name check everybody. You got my point. But I wasn't able to, so I had FOMO following you guys on social media from afar.
Yeah. And also, you know, the unfortunate part is we also have to work, right, while we're there. So
yes,
the work is a ton of fun. But outside of that, right, running into people, current colleagues, former colleagues, Radio Row around town, you know, having meals, that's also a lot of the fun as well in getting to go to different places. So, no, it was great. Honestly, I wish it could be every week. But like Christmas comes but once a year, and that's what makes it special as well.
Yeah, and look, I got to look up, and as I said, follow you guys on social media. I also got to look up and see my NBC colleagues like Jack Collinsworth yesterday on Alcatraz, which was fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, there's Aaron Donald on a boat. I saw Aaron at the NFC Championship game. He's like, I think I'm going to do some stuff for NBC. I'm like, oh, dude, that's awesome. Like, good for you, man. Break a leg. And then I look up. He's on a boat, and I hit him up. I'm like, dude, you're on a boat? You didn't tell me that part. It was awesome. Anyway,
you never know. Super Bowl week. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, you're on a boat. I feel like, what about Bob? Bill Murray? I'm sailing. Although not really. We hit the Seahawks. Let's hit the Patriots side as well. Much like the Seahawks, they were just a massive out of nowhere team. They were picking top five, obviously. They have the new head coach, complete roster turnover. No one thought the Patriots were going to get here. A massive long shot out of the AFC. Looking ahead or looking back, Ben, take this however you want to do it. Like, makes sense from where you sit, your job of the Patriots season.
Yeah, I mean, look, much like the Seahawks, we mentioned last week, right? It was the most unlikely matchup in terms of preseason odds ever, right? And the Seahawks were 60-1, which is a big long shot. The Patriots were at least 80-1 at BetMGM, longer at some other sports books. So they weren't expected to be here. Now, that being said, I don't think anyone necessarily expected Drake May to take that step from rookie year to this year as well, and very easily could have won the MVP, finished just runner-up, and was absolutely fantastic in the regular season. I think some of the questions that people had was that regular season, how much of that is a product of Drake May playing much better, which clearly a lot of it was, and how much of it was a product of that really easy schedule as well, right? Because we saw when they got in the playoffs against elite defenses, in each of these games now in the playoffs, he was sacked at least five times, right? So it's not like Joe Burrow, that Titans game a couple years ago, I think he got sacked nine times in one game. He was sacked at least five times in each of these games, six times in the Super Bowl. And it just seemed like against those elite defenses, whether that's Drake May, that's a combination of coaching as well, that's lack of having that kind of standout number one wide receiver, their offense just flat out wasn't good. There isn't really any other way to put it. And that defense helped carry them throughout some of those games. You know, against the Texans, they were down 10-7 in the second quarter before that pick six, right? Against the Broncos, they were down 7-0, could have been 10-0 or 14-0. We talked about that fourth down conversion. It was still 7-0 when Jarrett Stidham had that debacle and kind of handed the Patriots the ball. All of a sudden, they score a touchdown. It's 7-7. I thought it was really interesting as we went into this Super Bowl. One of the big questions was going to be, okay, we know the Seahawks defense is really good against the pass as well. They're also number one in DVOA against the run. Are the Patriots going to be able to run the ball at all? And the answer was no, right? Rhamondre Stevenson, I think he had 7 for 23. Travion Henderson didn't have any rushing. Drake May had a couple scrambles, but not really. And ultimately, their offensive line, Will Campbell, we kept seeing throughout the playoffs, right? Elite rushers giving him trouble. The Seahawks were a top 10 pressure rate team while also blitzing at a very infrequent rate. So basically their front four would just get pressure. But then when they did bring five, they got home at the highest rate in the league. And I think we saw that with the Witherspoon blitzes, right? Really timed well, got there. And ultimately, they just kind of made Drake May uncomfortable. I think that's the easiest way to put it.
Will Campbell allowed 14 pressures. Now, there are other pressure stats, PFF, whatever. The ones we're going with from NGS, from the NFL, from really NFL Network's compilation here, but the official ones are 14 pressures, which is the tied for the most in a single postseason game in the NGS era, which goes back to 2018. It ties Sam Tevy, who was playing right tackle in a game for the Chargers in the playoffs in 2018, against the Patriots. He had a bad day. He's a top five pick. We've seen some of these bad days, though. Don't forget Myles Garrett had five sacks on Drake May in a game this year. Now they weren't all on Will Campbell. They moved him around. They moved him inside a little bit. But Mike McDonald brought the blitz. He brought the house. And that was not, as you pointed out, something that they usually did. They played covers. They played zone. And they get to you regardless. What I saw a lot of on social media, and well, and I didn't like it. I get the piling on. But there are a lot of people, Ben, who were watching going, oh, you see, yeah, Drake May's really not that good. The schedule was that easy. They only had to cross four time zones. They never had to cross or go west of the Mississippi until the Denver game in the postseason. The Seahawks, conversely, had five games in the East Coast, and they had a game in Nashville. They were constantly traveling. They were battle-tested. And that, yeah, the Patriots aren't good. I have said, and I've said this last week in San Francisco and throughout the season, both can be true, they had a very easy schedule. The numbers do not lie. Also, I thought they had a very good team. There's also the, well, maybe Drake May's shoulder wasn't as healthy as we thought it was. He was not on the final injury report. He was adamant during the week, whether it was to Scott Hansen Monday night on opening night or whenever there was media availability, that his shoulder was okay. But he also admitted after the game that he took a painkilling injection. I'm not saying the Patriots would have won if no painkilling injection was needed. But I'm also saying that these sweeping judgments, I guess I'm saying it, Ben, of the Patriots from that game, I think are unfair. He's a good quarterback. They have a bright future. And this team collectively has a bright future. But that game and that performance was really, really bad.
Yeah. And I think your point's exactly how I put it. Both things can be true. He has a very bright future. And also there are different levels. And I don't think right now, which is totally fine, he's on that Matthew Stafford, Josh Allen, you know, Joe Burrow, top tier of quarterbacks who is going to win a game necessarily for you. And he needs that team around him as well. Now, he can elevate a team, certainly, but we just saw that consistently in these playoffs. Again, that's why I think it wasn't as surprising for me, at least, kind of what happened in the Super Bowl, because we'd seen him against these great defenses, right? The Chargers also have very good defense. They scored 16 points, right? So it's not like any of these playoff games, it was like, all right, well, in a couple of them, he struggled, but they put up 34 against this team. Like, it was pretty consistently happening. He's holding the ball a little bit too long. And I think in the Super Bowl, Dan Orlovsky did a great breakdown this morning of kind of, because of Will Campbell, it's just all these are moving chess pieces, right? And because Will Campbell can't block one-on-one, you bring more help to his side. Well, that also means potentially you're not getting more receivers out in routes. And also then Devin Witherspoon is blitzing from the other side. And so you're getting pressure with the four, you're getting pressure with the blitz. And you can see Drake May just kind of speeding up his processing. You know, I don't always take it back to the Vikings, right? But he did look a little like J.J. McCarthy has looked in some games where just he's moving faster. He's processing faster than he needs to. And the Seahawks defense is super fast. They're all over the field. There aren't very big windows. But you saw some of those third down throws could have been made. Maybe he was throwing it a little too hard, anticipating a little too much. And when they just couldn't get that first down, I think they had 5-3 and outs. That was the problem. And then they went into halftime. You have that super long halftime in the third quarter. I think they had, let's see here, one first down via penalty. They ran 14 plays. They had 32 yards. They went three and out three times and they lost a fumble. So that was coming out of a 45-minute halftime with all the adjustments. There just didn't seem like there was anything that they could do. The screen game wasn't working. The running game wasn't working. The deep passes weren't working. And ultimately, their defense played really well in this game. There's just only so much that you can do.
I kind of feel like, because, look, the Patriots came so close to taking one the other way. Marcus Jones, who's an all-pro return man, if Marcus Jones had gotten his hands on one of those early, he's going the other
way.
He
was close.
Christian Gonzalez, who played a fantastic game, had been able to take one of those the other way early. Maybe it breaks the dam. It gives them some momentum. I know, Patrick Labon, you don't like momentum. Momentum is a real thing. I promise you. It also changes the way Mike McDonald potentially plays defense. If the Patriots get out to the early lead, it didn't happen. And Drake May couldn't stretch the field. They finally got in the end zone late when you're like, all right, well, you got to take some shots. Look what happens. You take some shots. You're able to get into the end zone and stretch the field. But it was too little too late. Looking ahead, because I know the Seahawks and the Rams are already Super Bowl favorites, if you want to play the long game here for 2026, where are the Patriots, Ben?
Yeah, so the Patriots are kind of in that middle of the pack. It's going to be a fascinating offseason. I believe 17 of the 32 teams have odds of 30-1 or better. So there's just a lot of teams bunched up, basically. And even the Seahawks at 8-1, the Rams at 9-1. That's a long shot for a favorite, right? Usually a favorite might be 6-1, 5-1, plus 425, depending on the year. So there isn't really that consensus team. The Patriots are 15-1, tied with the Chiefs, which is a really interesting, and tied with the Chargers at 15-1. So I think all those numbers are kind of interesting in there. But the Patriots, like, I think people think they'll be there. They obviously have some money to spend as well. They do have to figure out, you know, you took Will Campbell at four, hoping that's your franchise left tackle. Is he that left tackle? Does he have to be moved inside? They'll have those questions to answer. They do have money to spend in free agency. The difficulty is, again, you just had that historically easy schedule. You also went through the playoffs not facing many of the best quarterbacks in the AFC, and now you have to play that first place schedule as well. So it'll be interesting kind of to see. I think they could have next year what some teams happens to a lot of teams, which is they could have a better team and probably will have a worse record, not win the division necessarily just because of the strength of that schedule, maybe injury luck, anything else. So they're going to be around, but I think it's not Patriots Dynasty 2.0. The Bills are gone. The Chiefs are gone. The Ravens are gone. You know, all these teams, like, they'll be in the mix, but the AFC still has a lot of contenders. It just so happened a lot of them weren't in the playoffs or really viable contenders this year.
What's so nuts about what you just listed, all those AFC odds, is that the Patriots, with an historically easy schedule, like I said, Patriot fans, don't get mad. It is just a fact. Like, congratulations. There are 20 other teams that would take Mike Vrabel. There are 25 other teams that would take Drake May off your hands if you wanted to give either of them up. Like, celebrate it. You had a great, great season. Their odds to get back next year or to win it next year that you just laid out are the same as Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. I would think, top of my head, that there is a natural assumption that the Chiefs would rebound. They still have Patrick Mahomes, they have Andy Reid, and that their odds, Ben, would be higher than the odds of the Patriots catching lightning in a bottle against a tougher schedule and with the 31st pick, not a top five pick, and doing this again.
For sure. And look, the Chiefs, that 15-1, that's their worst odds since Patrick Mahomes' rookie year, or excuse me, his first year starting in 2018, right? So they're used to being,
right,
you know, 8-1, 6-1, plus 450, et cetera. And a lot of that, obviously, the health concern around Mahomes and how the team looked, right? We think of the Chiefs as they're kind of inevitable. This was one of the years where all of a sudden they weren't winning all of those close games they usually win. They're losing some of them. Travis Kelce, we're not sure if he's coming back. So there are some concerns around the team as well and the infrastructure that haven't necessarily been there when it's just seemed like, all right, it's the Chiefs and everyone else. But yeah, you also just, you keep kind of coming back to the Bills too and just thinking, man, they got to be kicking themselves that this was, you know, that year that they really had that chance. And even the Broncos, right? You could make an argument the Broncos get to the Super Bowl if Bo Nix doesn't have kind of a fluke injury and isn't injured for the AFC Championship game. They obviously had a great season too. Who knows if they can replicate that, win another division, very tough AFC West. So the AFC is going to be fascinating next year. As I said, I think the Patriots will be around. They're going to be in the mix. I just think everyone's always quick to be like, all right, well, they made it now, so they'll just, let's put them in the AFC Championship game. It's like, that's basically Patrick Mahomes and nobody else, right? And even he is not going to make the championship game every single season.
Who's got the longest odds? Because, you know, Clint Kubiak confirmed to a friend of the program, Stacey Dales. By the way, great job, Dales. You got the great video on the Caleb Williams to Cole Kmet video in the end zone.
That was a great video.
So Dales, basically on live TV, gets Clint Kubiak to admit, we all knew it, that he was going to be the Raiders head coach. So great job, Dales. But who's got the longest? Let me guess. I'm going to say the Jets have the longest odds, or you group a whole bunch of teams together, the Jets, the Raiders, unfortunately, the Browns at the bottom, right?
The Jets, they're actually the Cardinals and Dolphins, 250 okay. to one. The Browns, 150 to one. They're same as the Raiders and the Saints. So the next kind of tier up there.
So I'm watching that last night, and I know a lot of Browns fans. Look, fans of any team that didn't make it, including maybe even like the Bills or the Chiefs or teams that you know still have good teams and great quarterbacks, Hall of Fame quarterbacks, you're watching this going, man, we are so, so, so far away because it is that hard to get there, which is what the Patriots feel deep inside. Like, are we ever going to get here again, even though they have a long, long history? That was their 13th. Someone texted me, like a Browns fan last night, like, man, we're so far away. And I'm like, I don't think so. Don't get mad at me because you have a great defense. And the Seahawks proved last night how they have a very good offense. Don't get me wrong. But it was their defense that won. You can win with defense is my point. Find a way to score 20 points
for sure.
a game. if you have an elite defense. Mike McDonald, the first head coach since Chuck Knoll to win a Super Bowl when you are the team's primary defensive play caller. You can win with a defensive head coach. Now, the Browns just got an offensive head coach. The Jets have a defensive head coach. The Cardinals and the Raiders now with their new head coaches are offensive head coaches. But you can do it with an elite defense and enough offense to get by. It helps if you have a little more than enough to get by. But the Browns are one of those teams that has, even though they are picking sixth overall and they won only five games, they have an elite defense. They have a team by a defensive player of the year. I know I'm rambling here on the Browns, but you get my point here. All right.
No, I was going to add next. I was just going to add, you had the Texans, right? And you had the Broncos, both sure. elite defenses with just enough offense who are right there. And if CJ Stroud Perfect. Plays yeah. a regular game, they're in the AFC Championship.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just get enough offense. Just get by. Those teams have quarterbacks. They have figured that out. The Browns are still trying to figure out. It might be Shador, might not be Shador. The Cardinals have Kyler Murray. Got to figure out what to do there. The insiders were telling you on Sunday that Kyler Murray could have played his last game there. Probably easier to trade him than to cut him. But a lot of teams with quarterback questions here. And the Raiders hold the number one overall pick, so they can take a quarterback, especially one from Indiana, if they so choose. Coming up next, there was, speaking of rookies and speaking of defense, an ugly story out of Florida. We'll update you on James Pierce coming up next on our post-Super Bowl 60. It is officially the off-season edition of Inside Coverage. It is a post-Super Bowl road edition here. By the way, 29-13, the final score. If you don't know already, the season is over 285 games. It's Inside Coverage. Hi, I'm Andrew. Ben Fox is here as well. Ben, want to go back to the whole Raider thing. I know we mentioned the Raiders' Super Bowl odds, but didn't get your 2 cents. Not on Clint Kubiak's way of announcing it to Stacey Dales, who gets a gold medal for reporting on the field. But just overall, what it does for the Raiders from where you sit.
Yeah, I think it's a great hire, legitimizes them a little bit. It's funny because from a betting perspective, obviously now the Raiders in Las Vegas, every year they're a big liability for the sports books. There were a couple bets that would have won $1 million, $2 million if the Raiders win the Super Bowl, which in general sports books are very happy to take because it hasn't been something that's been a threat. They obviously have needed to make the playoffs first. But I think you saw Clint Kubiak throughout the season have great game plans. And then in the Super Bowl as well, they did essentially what the Patriots did to the Broncos in the AFC Championship game, which is we don't need to go and try and win this game 50-7. We need to not turn the ball over. We need to play safe, basically play to the game conditions. I think that's really good coaching, right? And we saw that a little bit the opposite in, let's say, the Bills-Broncos right before halftime. Sometimes you have to know your personnel. You don't let Josh Allen run potentially, right? Have that turnover. They didn't let Sam Darnold throw as much, throw downfield, have that potential turnover, which, let's be honest, the way that game was going, that's the only way the Patriots were winning that game is a pick six or it's 3rd and 12. He drops back on some play action, gets stripped. Patriots are like 3rd and 12. They were handing the ball off, running 30 seconds off the clock and saying, we're good. We're going to punt the ball, try and score 3 times on our defense. And so I think that speaks to him as well. And everyone in that organization you hear, you know, in the post-game press conferences gives him a lot of credit as well. So it seems like a great hire, obviously a football family as well. He's been around football all his life. So I think it's good for the Raiders. And ultimately, they're one of those franchises. I feel like football is better when the Raiders are good and relevant. And so I'm excited to see if they can make a already really difficult AFC West that much better.
Yeah, my thought on the Raiders is this. Clint Kubiak's a good coach, and I think he's going to do just fine. I'm curious how he is as the guy in front of the entire room and not just the offense. He's kind of a, I don't say soft-spoken. He's not the loudest guy. Not all leaders need to be loud. We've had this conversation a lot. I firmly believe that Mike McDonald is not the loudest guy. I mean, he's relatively subdued. I told you last week when we were in San Francisco about my experience with him at the owners' meetings, the annual meeting, as it's called, right after he got hired just, 2 years and 10 days ago, whatever it is just now. If I'm the Raiders, and this is just me, I'm making a trade. They could do one of two things. They could trade out of one and they could go get a free agent quarterback and say, hey, we love Fernando Mendoza, but we love picks more. Auction off the pick because they need draft capital to truly rebuild this roster. Or you trade Max Crosby. And I know we talked about this on the show last week. There are a lot of people, if not most people in the league, that think Max Crosby has played his last game as a Raider. So if you can get two number ones for Max Crosby, and you can sit here with potentially four number ones over the next two seasons, you're in fantastic position. They need draft capital, and I would move on. I love him. And he's going to make somebody an instant contender. Max Crosby in Chicago, sign me up for that with Dennis Allen, right? That's the missing piece. Remember, the Bears wanted Myles Garrett last year. The Browns were not going to trade him. If I'm Buffalo, I mean, they're always in need, and they're always in search of that veteran pass rusher, Rams. Whether it was Bosa or Von Miller. The Rams, it doesn't fit. Remember, they've got to pay Stafford. They probably have to give him a 50% raise. He made 40 last year. The number is 60 for Dak. I don't know that it fits what they have done. They have a really young core on defense, and it's time to pay guys like Kobe Turner and Byron Young. And next year they have to pay Jared Verse and Braden Fisk. Not have to. They'll be through 3 years of their rookie contracts.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't know if it works there. But if I'm the Raiders, I am looking to make a massive move and get extra number ones because I think. All right. Anything else? I know there are a whole bunch of props. Look, it's the I was gonna say the Super Bowl of props. It is the Super Bowl of props, right? In your world here, everybody's interested in the Super Bowl for their own reasons. Let's put it that way, Ben.
Yeah, for sure. Look, there are thousands of ways to bet on the game in general. We'll get some exact numbers later today and as kind of the week and weeks go along from different states. Sports books and odds makers I talked to generally did well, right? The public was on the Seahawks generally to cover. There was some New England money line money, but anytime the game stays under the total, that's a good thing. Jaxon Smith-Njigba, anytime touchdown was in a lot of parlays. Kenneth Walker to score a touchdown in a lot of parlays. And you also JSN under. Say that again.
Kenneth Walker busted free in the fourth quarter when that game was basically already over and it got called back.
Yes. So that would have been a massive, right? That also puts the game over the total, gives him a touchdown. That would have been a massive hit. And that was actually one thing talking to odds makers, I think as well as they did, and obviously each book's a little different, that fourth quarter did hurt a little bit, right? Just because you had Drake May going over his passing yards, some other scoring. Anytime you're getting somebody scoring a touchdown, Mac Collins, that adds in those same game parlays and other things. So that hurt a bit. Just generally more yardage is bad, right? Whether that's players going over or stuff like that. But in general, no safety, no overtime. The defensive score from the Seahawks did hurt. Just about every odds maker I talked to was like, oh, that one was a little painful. They certainly would have rather not had that. But in general, I think they did pretty well. And ultimately, the bet I'd reported on all the way back in August, that guy who had the three Seahawks bets, 50,000 on them to make the playoffs, 50,000 to win the NFC, 50,000 to win the Super Bowl. He wins 3 million off of that bet. He did come back and hedge half of it. So he wins 1.5 million on that. He had that bet at another sports book as well. So just an amazing story that was kind of a throwaway when we were out there for our fantasy football weekend in Vegas back in August. And I was talking to an odds maker there. They were plenty happy to take Seahawks action to win the Super Bowl. And here we are. And that's why it's the NFL. Anything can happen.
You credit, man. You've had your eye on that thing the entire year, and you have updated it on this show not every Thursday, but a lot of Thursdays, the entire season. Did you, even though it's not your money, right? Like, you weren't the guy?
It is not. To be clear. No. You think I'd be on this show today? I'd be on my island.
did you take any satisfaction in that hitting last night?
Yeah, look, I think you're always rooting for a story a bit. And so,
sure.
Generally, like, that was one you're rooting for a bit. Ultimately, I think the fact that the guy came back to Vegas and hedged the weekend before the Super Bowl was already kind of an interesting story, in that he just decided, like, hey, I don't have full confidence. I would rather know I'm going to win a lesser amount and kind of not have to worry about the game versus I could win $3 million or potentially nothing. And so ultimately, hedging is, everyone has a different opinion. It depends on a lot of different factors. I thought that was fascinating. And yeah, just, I think it's interesting because before the season, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember a ton of Seahawks buzz, right? I remember certainly the Rams as one of the best teams, the Cardinals as the sleeper. I don't remember people being like, the Seahawks, you got to watch out. It was more like, oh, wow, they traded away Geno Smith for Sam Darnold. Like, great move. You know, they didn't look amazing the year before. And they just kind of throughout the season kept winning and winning and winning. And at some point, I think people started to buy in. But everyone was still waiting for Sam Darnold to turn into that pumpkin. He didn't have his best game in the Super Bowl. He also didn't need to. And I think he plays well with that team. And that's why they're champions.
Yeah, we're talking about that with Turbo before, you know, like the different worlds of Sam Darnold. There were some Seahawks fans that went like, all right, I don't mind moving on from Geno, but really, Sam Darnold, isn't this the same guy that got sacked 9 times when the Vikings blew up in the playoffs? And then there were Vikings fans that were like, well, wait a minute, we're going to roll with JJ? We're really giving up on Sam because of week 18 of the wild card game, and then especially, obviously, a couple of weeks ago when Sam leads them to a victory in the NFC Championship game, and then a couple of days later, they blow up their front office and they fire Kwesi Adolfo-Mensa. Like, the same player could be viewed differently in two different towns, and I'm happy for Sam Darnold. Like, I could not be happier for Sam Darnold, and Ben's happy for the guy that came in and hammered the Seahawks. No one's happy in Atlanta right now with the James Pierce story. So James Pierce had a great rookie season. The Falcons moved up somewhat surprisingly. I could tell you around the league when the Falcons moved up on draft night last year and they jumped from the second round back into the first round of the Rams, dropped back down. They eventually took Terrence Ferguson, the tight end out of Oregon. And the Falcons took James Pierce, the pass rusher, out of Tennessee. A lot of people around the league were surprised because James Pierce did not have the best off-field draft grade, let's put it that way, coming out. There are a lot of teams that had said, you're not drafting James Pierce. That's just a fact. The Falcons were not one of those teams. He got through the season. He played really well. He was up for Defensive Rookie of the Year. That eventually went to Carson Schwessinger, who went 33rd overall after James Pierce. And then he went home. And then he was arrested over the weekend, and he is charged with 5 felonies. It has to do with a domestic dispute there with his girlfriend, who's a WNBA player. Her name is Rakia Jackson. This was, again, in Florida. If he's convicted on any of these 5 felonies, one of them's got a minimum of 5 years in jail. There is a lot to be determined. This is a long way from going through the courts and a long way from league discipline. But Ben, in your world, how does this affect the Falcons as we open up the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a team building perspective and from an odds perspective, right, the one thing that was always lacking in Atlanta year after year was the pass rush, right? And that's why they addressed that this year in the draft with not one, but 2 pass rushers, including trading their first round pick to the Rams for the pick they used this one to take James Pierce. I think it's also always instructive, you know, when these front offices are doing all of this due diligence on the draft, a lot of it is off the field as well, right? Whether they're talking to high school coaches and teachers and hiring private investigators, like, they are doing all this work on the football player and also the person. Both of those go into it. And James Pierce had some off-field concerns, right? The on-field talent was obvious. That's why he's a potential first-round pick and end up going there. But the off the field is some of the concerns. And this is something that plays out every year, right? In terms of, you have players that are really, really talented and do those pluses on the field aren't outweighed by some of the potential negatives off the field. And if they can kind of stay on the straight and narrow, you may be able to get a player who's incredibly talented who drops for a reason that has nothing to do with his play on the football field. For the Falcons, it's, you know, we obviously have to see kind of how this plays out. We've seen obviously players get suspended depending on what happens with the legal process, regardless through the player conduct policy. So there's a lot that can go on here. The Falcons pass rush obviously was better, but when you trade a future first round pick for a player, it just generally doesn't work out with a pass rusher. I remember a couple years ago, I think the Saints, who again thought they were a player away, right, trade up for Marcus Davenport, who is fine, but then also gets injured and ends up not kind of being the first round pick that they thought. So you really have, when you're trading up for that player, and the Falcons, I think few would think that they were a player away, right, from, you know, making the playoffs, sure, but being a contender, it's just you're giving up a lot for a player. And then especially when it's a player who had some of these potential red flags, it's just now you're in a situation where you're just kind of waiting to see. But that is a massive loss potentially on the defense, because it's also who you could have picked as well. You don't have anyone in this first round pick in this year's draft.
Right. And that first round pick turns into number 13. The Rams now have 13 and I believe 26. So 13 would have been the Falcons pick. Look, I could tell you, and the Falcons took a risk. Terry Fontenot is no longer there as GM, nor is the head coach Raheem Morris. But it worked when it came to production this year. Jalen Walker, the other guy you mentioned, and James Pierce played great. And that defense finally, with Jeff Ulbrich as the DC, got to the quarterback. Like they hadn't sacked the quarterback in 15 years. They had, like, John Abraham was the last guy that got to the quarterback. They got to the quarterback, and it worked. So, like, you're like, okay, this was the right thing to do. But when the trade happened, I could tell you, I got texts from around the league saying, wait a minute, they traded up for that guy? That guy. Okay.
Right.
Interesting.
The thing right. is, it both... And, it go ahead. Go ahead.
No. You go ahead.
I was just going to say... All of these matter too, like where you are within the team building process, right? Like in the NBA, the Pelicans traded, I think, an unprotected first for Derek Queen, like great player, but then you give away this first round pick, you know? And so but the Pelicans also not exactly a contender. So same thing with the Falcons. If you're making that trade, even though it's a great pick, like he really needs to be that missing piece. And so it's a lot to give up.
Yeah.
And the Rams were smart enough to take it. The deal was on the table and it's going to work out for the Rams. Obviously this season, it worked out a little bit for the Falcons, but it's going to be judged harshly depending on how all this, you know, plays out over the next few months and years.
The Giants traded up to get Jackson Dart. So far, that looks like it worked. I mean, the Ravens, obviously, in 2018, famously traded up to 32, and they took Lamar Jackson. That certainly did work. Not every trade up is a bad trade. By the way, I saw Derek Queen, my limited NBA knowledge, in person in Cleveland a couple of weeks ago. The guy looked fantastic, and the NBA is very different. There are protected first-round picks and, you know, lottery-exempt first-round picks and all this. I mean, imagine if the NFL said... Imagine if the NFL, they did that. Like the Falcons say, we'll trade you next year's first round pick, but if it's in the top 10, we get to keep it. Can you imagine if the NFL worked? The NFL doesn't work that way, okay? And I'm glad it does not work that way. And the Rams are thrilled it does not work that way. And now Kevin Stefanski, without a first round pick, with Ian Cunningham as the new GM, Matt Ryan, the new president of football, they have to navigate their first offseason crisis, if you will. Without that first-round pick, and have to figure out now how to handle this James Pierce situation, which will go through the courts and likely be subject to league discipline under the personal conduct policy as well. All right, let's do one more thing before we go. Do we have the band as I sit in the hotel room? Yes! Ben, you're going first. What do you got?
I love the band too. Every time it was even better in person that we had it, but yeah, mine is just we always assume right with these teams that make the Super Bowl a little ahead of schedule potentially, just don't assume that they're going to be right back there next year. Right? Nobody's saying that the Patriots are never going to make the Super Bowl again, but I think we're always quick to say, "Hey, it's the Dynasty 2.0. They had a couple of years. The Patriots are back." And just always important to remember, they went through this year's playoffs. They didn't face Patrick Mahomes. They didn't face Josh Allen. They didn't face Lamar Jackson. They didn't face Joe Burrow. I would venture to say that's going to be almost impossible going forward in the next, let's just say, 4 to 6 years or longer in the AFC, you're going to have to beat those teams. That's who you have to get past. That's why the Bills are going to be so upset they didn't make it this season. And so I think the Patriots took advantage of a good schedule, an easy schedule. They are a good team, not a great team. I think they're different levels, and they clearly were on a lower level than the Seahawks. And ultimately, they could be back, but they kind of had an opportunity here. Just because they were ahead of schedule doesn't mean that next year, when you're kind of more on track with where you think you'll be, that you'll get further. There's a chance, and a good chance, I think, they don't make it nearly as far as they did this year.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what's so disappointing when your team loses deep in any playoff season. It's so hard to get back, not only for the fans. Listen, the fans know that, the entire organization, the players, everybody knows that. And everyone knows as well that this group, as constructed, is never going to be the same, right? Change is inevitable in pro sports, especially in the NFL, and it is hard to get over it. Truly, truly hard to get over. Patriots fans, I hear you. I feel you. All right, my one more thing is this. So the commercials, we haven't ranked the commercials yet, but you saw the Uber Eats one with McConaughey, right? And
that was good.
Who's the other one that was in? It was McConaughey and Bradley Cooper, and they're listing all the players. The NFL players over the years that have food names. They included my dear friend and our sideline Browns radio network, former Patriot with three rings, Gerard Cherry. They threw his name in there when they're listing names at the end of the commercial. Gerard, bless his heart. As soon as the commercial ran, posted on Instagram a picture from his kitchen, I assume, or whatever Super Bowl party he was at, with this whole, you know, table full of food, basically like going at Uber Eats and at McConaughey and at Bradley Cooper. He added them all, saying like, I'm here. Did you call me? Like, I'm ready for my moment if anybody
Tag
wants to
all.
Write me a check. Exactly. And so all of us on our Browns text thread went nuts, and Browns fans went nuts, like, Gerard, well done. So I thought Gerard just like ran to the kitchen to take a photo. I just texted Gerard, Ben, as we were coming on the air. I'm like, dude, did you know you were going to be in that? And he wrote back, yes, LOL. So obviously someone gave him the heads up, or I don't know. Hopefully they wrote him a check. Gerard, I hope he got paid for that thing. Just, it's a name drop. That's all it is. He had that picture ready to tag those guys and ready to try to get on the gravy train. Gravy, not part of the food, but get on the gravy train. So Gerard, I hope you get paid.
That was smart. Well, I like the Pro Football Hall of Fame as the juicer as well. That was
there you go.
That was cleverly done. There you go. Yeah, it was a good commercial.
That was fantastic. I watched with our Gold Zone crew, Matt Eisman, Sarah Hughes, our producer, not the Olympic medalist Sarah Hughes, but the amazing producer and figure skate podcaster Sarah Hughes. And we had a great group. Anyway, we have a great group here as well. I want you to know, like everyone listening and watching, that we are not going anywhere. We are still coming back because there is no off season. We're not going to do a show on Tuesday. We're going to get into a 2-show-a-week rhythm, and we will be back with another edition of Inside Coverage on Wednesday. For Ben and for Robert Turbin, my name is Andrew Siciliano. Thank you for listening to, thank you for watching Inside Coverage on Yahoo.